Hello and welcome to a very special episode of More From Grace, where today we are joined by Brian Moore in front of a live Sports Gazette audience. Now, most of you will probably know Brian for his legendary co-commentary partnership with the late Eddie Butler. But Brian's here today to talk about a variety of topics, and without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to my co-host, Julia Anderson.
Yeah, thanks, Will. So, Brian, you recently got your master's degree in psychology at the age of 62. What inspired you to go back to study?
Initially, to do some work as a psychotherapist, but in particular, even though I played nearly all my career as an amateur, I played 1 year in the professional era when I didn't actually sign a contract. But so when I gave up, because I was a partner in a law firm in London, I thought, well, actually, what you're doing is essentially a super hobby. It's very serious, but it doesn't pay the bills. So you'll be okay. You'll miss it a lot. But actually, because your day-to-day existence, 9 till 6, 7 or whatever, is going to be the same, you'll be okay. I was all over the place. Got divorced. Probably wouldn't have got divorced. Emotionally went on, you know, I then started... You know, I then went to live in Soho with all the attendant benefits, stroke, temptations, you know, and I didn't know what was going on. Psychologically, I was up, I was down, emotionally, I was depressed, and these were probably the days before mental health started to be talked about in the mainstream. And I just thought every athlete, and it also applies to the armed forces, it applies to big business executives who is moving either from a job to retire completely or moving from a job or being institutionalized to another job, they are going to find, especially if they're being successful and high profile, peculiar psychological challenges that they are not ready for, that no one tells them about, but they need to know about, because I don't know any athlete who's had no psychological sequelae, and I know athletes who've gone from having minor problems, to dying, to addiction, and everything else in between.
So, Brian, so what do you think your aspirations are then in the world of psychology?
So it is to practice in that area, preparing people for... The right word is transitioning, but you can't use transitioning because that means something else now, and in a helpful, you know, gender way. So the transfer... to address that specific issue, not the employment stuff, but to deal with the fallout, to plan to stop it or ameliorate it or minimize it, and then to be clinically qualified, which I am, to deal genuinely the psychiatric fallout for it if and when they have problems, however minor or major they are. So that's the reason to do that.
Do you think it helps that you've experienced what it's like to play at the highest level of rugby?
I've spent years on Twitter arguing with people I shouldn't have done. And let me give you an example. I'm adopted. I posted something about adoption, and loads of people from America start coming on and saying, you said you're not an expert, which I freely admitted. I am an expert. I said, why? Because I've been through this. I said, yeah, I've been through it. Don't make me an expert. It just means I've been through it. Experts are people who have done research, you know, and see wider things, not just one thing, you know. If you've been in a car crash, it doesn't mean you're an expert in, you know, in car crash technique, does it, you know? So, in a similar way, it doesn't make you an expert, but what it does do is it does give you genuine empathy, and one of the pillars of clinical psychology is empathy with the clients. So I do know what all these feelings are like, and with the training, psychologically and clinically, I can apply that. And what that means is you can still practice in the same area and be psychologically, psychiatrically, and counseling trained, and you can try and have empathy in the sense that, well, it's more sympathy, and there's a very subtle difference, but and you're still qualified to do it, but there is nothing like, if you go into 12-step counseling with addicts, they talk about the power of one addict counselling another. because there's a sort of shorthand. You know, when people are describing their feelings and their emotions to you, they know that you understand exactly what they mean. And language and terminology is really important in counselling and psychotherapy, because unless you get the right descriptions, you might attribute a certain cause to something that they don't actually mean. So if you don't have the experience yourself, you've not been through sport or whatever, and the difficulties, you might not exactly understand. Whereas if you've experienced it, you do know. And also, from their point of view, I think it gives them confidence to say, well, actually, I don't mind them. Because, I mean, the clinical relationship is absolutely everything, because you can be the best clinician in the world. If you don't get on with the client, they're not going to be as forthcoming. And it's absolutely necessary for them to be as totally honest and as forthcoming as they can be, as soon as they can be, because you get more benefit. And that just breaks that barrier down and helps that straight away.
So, Brian, I was just wondering, how are you unique in this regard?
There are very few athletes who have gone down this route. There are lots of athletes who have gone into performance coaching and that sort of stuff. And it's still one of the areas. And one of the difficulties is, I'm working with a couple of athletes who are going to retire after France, is they say, well, don't tell my coach I'm speaking to you, because my coach is going to say, I don't want them talking about retirement. They've got to go for a gold medal. Last thing I want them doing is having negative thoughts about it. And I said, if I was able to talk to them, I would say, actually, your athletes are already thinking about this. And the fact that they aren't voicing it and are saying, no, thought about it, no, put it on one side, doesn't mean to say it's not having an effect. And you would actually have a better athlete, because they'd feel happier rather than having the thing in the box that they keep having to stamp down and not address, going forward. But so that's an additional difficulty. The people don't understand the difference between, it's perfectly possible to have performance and performance psychology and also deal with it's not a binary issue.
You were just talking about players taking a step away from the game there.
Yeah.
Well, quite most notably, of course, Owen Farrell took a step away from the international game before the Six Nations.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, after now having your master's in psychology, how would you have addressed that situation with Owen, and how perhaps would you have advised him?
Well, look, I mean, there's been a degree of cynicism about after Farrell's decision, when people realised he was going to France, and some people quite uncharitably been saying, oh yeah, really? Because you just decided to go this week, did you? Because everyone knows it takes a while to negotiate your contracts and all that sort of stuff. So you must have been thinking about this. So it's an excuse. And I don't accept that, because I don't think even now it is easy for high profile people to come out and say whatever the Piers Morgans of this world say about people using it as an excuse. It is still very difficult for people to come out and admit psychological weakness, because everything, not least because everything in sport, sports psychology trains you to not admit that and to overcome things, and to eschew any feelings like that. I'm not sure. I don't know him very well. I've known of him and through his dad since he was 18. I've always found him a very, very straightforward lad, very competitive. I'm not sure that he didn't get to a situation where he thought, look, I've done this. Last 3 years, this is what I want to do. I've got 100 caps for England. And there has been this, I'm sorry to bore anyone about rugby technically, because if you don't necessarily follow it, there has been a genuine argument about whether the need to pick Farrell as a leader and pick him at centre has actually skewed England's whole attack for nearly 8 years, instead of picking him at fly half and then trying to get a centre partnership.
And do you agree with them?
I mean, you won't know this, but since 2003 with Tindall and Greenwood, there have been over 100 different England centre partnerships. Not necessarily starting, but actually playing on the field. How are you ever going to get a settled attack, if you've got that sort of turnover? Well, you're not. And it is perfectly legitimate to argue that Farrell's, the need to pick Farrell as a captain on the field, and the fact that he can and has played centre, has skewed the whole thing. And had the managers been forced to say, we're going to pick you at fly half or nothing, then you might have had you know, a chance to get a settled attack, which is one of the problems that England have got at the moment anyway.
Yeah, and talking of mental health problems in rugby, a lot was made of the recent Netflix series, especially the extracts with Andrew Porter and Ellis Genge, which I thought were brilliant. Going on now into the second series, what do you think could be improved on in comparison to the first series, especially on that sort of narrative?
Well, I think all these things, but documentaries, what people, I believe, and your views are as important as mine, because you're of a different generation, you're of a Netflix generation, for want of a better thing, more so than me. And also, I know what it's like in a changing room and on the training field, and people who are viewing, I imagine, are wanting to get the insight as far as you can into what it is actually like to be there. Is that, you know? So the more personal you can make it, the more candid you can have people being without stitching them up, because they'll never do it again then the better. You know, if you look at the one of the best series, I thought, how many people have seen the Tour de France series? That you ought to look at that. That's eight things. And they're brutal in that, you know. They're just saying, actually, that's not fucking not good enough. You know, bang, bang. Guy falls off at the end of Tourmalet and he's sick. He said, mate, you messed that up. So, thank you. But, you know, the insight, it is simply that. It's getting to the areas where hitherto people haven't been. And you will get those if players and coaches are made to feel that they won't be stitched up, first of all, and that it is actually the way to sell the sport. Because rugby has to understand, compared to football, it is minute. The whole of the Premiership turnover in rugby is the same as Everton Football Club, one club. That's how big the difference is. I can name you five Premier League players whose wages and add-ons are bigger than every Premiership rugby player's wages. That's just five. You know, there is no comparison. Football is so much bigger. And football has 100 years of being the national sport. Having said that, rugby and to a certain extent cricket punch massively above their weight in terms of the media exposure from what they actually are. You know, no Premiership club would be in the top 500 of FTSE companies for turnover. They just wouldn't be. But they occupy a disproportionate amount of column inches and footage because they are emotional things. They're not just businesses. They are community things. They have histories. You know, no one remembers Shell's, you know, 1966 profits, do they, and run around saying that was the year we, you know. But they do remember the 66 World Cup. They do remember the 2003, you know, World Cup and, you know, and things like that. So it is a different proposition. That's how I think it could be done. Players and coaches will be reluctant because they do fear being stitched up. And also, and this is, I don't know how you get around this, social media is, to some extent, a neutral tool. It is just a form of communication. However, my sports editor a long time ago at the Telegraph, when it first came out, this is the best encapsulation, he said to me. He said, it is an impossible amalgam of the shout at the television, but immensely intimate at the same time. And what he meant was, a lot of people would go on Twitter and post or whatever, yeah, or X, it's going now, yeah. I refuse to call it X because I don't like Elon Musk, but it's the same as I'm in the front room shouting, oh, for fuck's sake, you know, why do you do this? So they'll go on, but that comes to the person, if they tag them, in the same way that a message of condolence about their mother dying, like in the Jamie George's mother's just died, in the same thing. And people say, well, don't read it. I say, well, unless you pay for a blue tick and you can have a long tweet, you know, 280 characters is four lines. It is very, you can read all four lines straight away, and funny enough, swear words and bad swear words, you can spot out the corner of your eye, so you know they're abusive. So it's either don't be on there, do be there. Everyone wants you to be on there to engage for the sport, to promote it. Fans love it when you do that. The downside is you'll get people who are anonymous, and these are the ones that annoy me more that people aren't even brave enough to identify themselves before they decide to launch into criticisms of one of you. So not only did you get that.
So do you think this greater degree then of exposure is actually beneficial in the wider picture for rugby players and pro athletes in general?
I think this was the case a bit with Farrell. He might have just said, oh, I know, do I need this anymore? I've had 100 caps. I've done my best. I'm still getting this. No, I'm off to France for my final 3 years. Why should I take this? And for people to say it comes with a territory, why does it come with a territory? You know, you wouldn't do this to... You think you know these people because you see them. You wouldn't do that to anyone else. And if you would and you stand up and are proud of it, then there's something wrong with you. You know, would you say that to his face? I fucking would. So you go up to him, a person you don't know, in the street and abuse him. Is that good? Do you think that's brave? Or, no, it's a... I've always, you know, it's ironic that this government who said they wouldn't make people register with their names because it would be an impingement on their social freedom, are then asking the same people to identify themselves before they vote, you know, which is a direct gerrymandering thing. I just think if social media, if you were made to give your name and address, you don't have to post as a person. You can have an avatar, you can have a thing, but in cases where there's been serious abuse or criminal acts or libel or defamation, the person should be able to get from the company your details straight away without having to go through a long pursuit. So ultimately, there is some accountability. Yeah, I understand why some people want to be anonymous, but it should not be the case to hide behind things just to be abusive, which unfortunately for a lot of things it is. And also, people, this is not necessarily sporting wise, but people have to understand, if you read and watch a lot of the stuff like Cambridge Analytica about Steve Bannon and other things, you've got to understand the organised nature now of certain campaigns against certain political points of view, against certain cultural things, which is what we're finding with the women in sport things. And you only need that to be directed malevolently against a player, a team, for you to find you're in a situation which is actually got out of hand and is very, very deeply unpleasant personally.
How have you dealt with maybe social media criticism, pushback, or just in general, maybe when you were commentating, like, bad comments?
The day I stopped not caring, the day I learned to take a different point of view about bias, because that's what everyone first said. I did it for 20 years with the Men's Six Nations. Early on, I understand why this was. It must have been very difficult for people who saw me on the field being, you know, rabidly English, very anti anyone I played. But what else do you expect players to do, or me to do? And then accept that in the commentary box, I was being fair. Because I said to him, look, first of all, I mean, I remember one complaint to the BBC trying to get me sacked, saying, he said the three things, this is why he should be sacked, one, two, three. I said, first one, I didn't actually say that, it wasn't me. Second one, what you said, I didn't actually say that. I said something akin to that, but didn't mean the same thing. And the third one is a technical one, and I'm sorry, but I was right. So before you write to my employer, try to get me sacked, for, you know, you might have the decency at least to get your facts right. But the day I went into the BBC complaints log and I found there were equal number of complaints of bias against me in a Calcutta Cup game from being biased towards England and Scotland, which if you're thinking, mind, you know, they're mutually exclusive. You can't be biased to both sides. I just thought, it is simple as this. Whatever you say, some people will like it, some people won't. Towards the end of my career, I think I actually got, because there's a sufficient gap between playing, and there were lots of viewers who'd never even seen me play, and I don't imagine anyone here has any idea who I am, apart from looking on the internet. No, you won't. Well, why would you? It's 40 years ago. That's the way things go. So you've got that, and towards the end, I actually did get at least people saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, but they weren't saying, you're biased. Because I used to say, take this example. I used to look at a piece of footage, and I say what I think and feel, and sometimes I make mistakes. Now, early on, and still, people say, you made that mistake because you're biased towards England. I said, no, I just made a mistake. And it happened to be in England's favour, so to speak. It's not because of that. It's just because I made an error, like everyone else does. And you also come to learn slowly that these are opinions, and there is no right or wrong. It's not one of the great things about sport itself is, if you think about it, it is one of the few areas of life where everyone agrees the criteria by which you win and lose, and there's no argument. I've won because I've scored more points, I've run quicker or thrown further. You might not think I'm any good. You know, I like a certain band, you like a certain band, can't prove they're better. You can say, well, they sold more albums, so what? That's not an agreed measure of quality. Whereas in sport, absolutely definitive. And that's one of the attractions for sports, for athletes, and especially one of the things that you have to counsel them to understand that they won't have when they come out. It is great to have black and white measures, because when you win, it's indisputable and it's fantastic. When you lose, it's equally bad the other way, but that's an addictive thing. And people say to me, you know, I said, the only thing I can equate emotionally of the same intensity is the birth of my four kids. And I said, but your kids don't get born every weekend. You know, you don't have 42 kids born a year, you know, for 18 years. But that's why it becomes seductive. So going back to the point about subjectivity, you've got to understand that it's an opinion, that's their opinion. I've finally grown up a little bit. The days I've lost on Twitter arguing with people about points that don't matter, about opinions which are not going to change anyway, and for which there are no standard and agreed answers and agreed rights and wrongs, you're better off saying, that's your opinion, fine, this is mine, let's leave it there. Because otherwise we're going to... And also, feeding into that narrative with a few people, the trolls and other things, where people actively like the fact that they're winding you up, you know, and you say, well, I remember saying, you know, well, look, you look at your life, you've spent the whole evening arguing with me, haven't you got anything better to do? And I thought, well, so have you. Haven't you got anything better to do? Yeah, you should stop doing this. And I still can't resist at some points, but I've got better at it.
Now let's just move back to the rugby for a second, Brian. Okay. So as a former Nottingham and Richmond player yourself, you've been able to experience the fantastic setups of Championship and National League One now, mm-hmm. teams. If I were to give you a blank piece of paper right now, how would you go about restructuring the English domestic setup?
This is not going to make me very popular with the Championship and Nottingham, and I know that. My old club actually wrote to the Telegraph and complained about one of my articles, saying he should go down and learn what's going on. No one listens to us. And I said, just because no one agrees with you doesn't mean say no one's listening. I understand what you're saying. I just don't agree with you. I'm sorry. And the Championship is a mess. Tiers 2, 3, 4 and 5 in England spend as much money on wages for players who are never going to be internationals and aren't good enough to be full-time pros as Rugby League Super League, without Rugby League Super League's attendances or their two TV deals. Is that sensible? No, it's not. Is that going to change? No, it's not, because, as I said, rugby is a small game. When you get people going on saying, brilliant, we've got 4,000 here, Ealing Trailfinders, you know, so what? That's not going to sustain you as a professional club. It can't even sustain you as a semi-professional club. And bear in mind this. I mean, Rob Andrew, good friend of mine now, wasn't at the time when we played because he married my former girlfriend. And but anyway, I didn't mind. Anyway, you know, he said to me at cricket, every county team breaks even or makes a small profit. But he said, we've got staff of 20. You know, the problem with rugby clubs, because of the substitutions, because of safety rules with front row and positional stuff, they're carrying squads of 45 people. If you could cut those by 10, that might be the difference between actually making money and, you know, no, or breaking even or losing 2 million a year. And this is a problem. None of these clubs are intrinsically solvent. They're wasting money on players who, I said, if you're good enough, why aren't you in a professional setup. And it's no good saying to me, I'm sorry, it's no good saying to me, 89 players have played for England from a championship, because you and I both know you've counted every player who's played one game for a championship club who's then gone to play for England. You haven't developed these players. You're not taking them through the academies. Something drastic needs to be done. And I know this, they will hate this, but I would say this. Your solution at the moment is give us more cash. That's it. As if you're suddenly going to transform yourselves into businesses that are providing their own players and providing the same. No, you're not. And if you had been, this would have happened in the near 30 years of professionalism. Why has it happened? Because it's not tenable. If I were to do it, I would look at a draft system, or at least a system where championship clubs were allied to universities or some form of higher education, so that you would get better educated players. The players who are not going to be pros because they are not good enough would then have a proper degree, you know, and be able to go and work, and you could genuinely say, and you've got this problem now starting in rugby that they've had for for 50 years in football, where all the kids come into the academies, you know that only one of them out of 100 or two of them is actually going to be a professional. And yet you'll con the parents and say, come down, we'll look after them, look after them. And there's nothing, they just throw them out the door, off you go. In the meantime, their education has suffered because they've been allowed not to do it, because Johnny's going to be a footballer or Jody's going to be a footballer, so no problem. It, you know, at least if you had that, you could even the playing field up with a draft system, you'd give people a, or like in you know, like American baseball, you could have a proper pathway where you had A, AA and AAA clubs where there are feeder clubs and the system is there. But unfortunately, that would mean Nottingham accepting that they are a feeder club for Leicester, and they're not going to do that. And I understand why they might not want to do that. All I'm saying is, you tell me your alternative, because at the moment, you haven't got one, apart from saying, give us more money from the RFU. And by the way, every pound we spend on your players, semi-pro players who aren't good enough to play for England anyway, every pound we spend on you can't be spent on grassroots rugby, which is where players are produced. The minis, the junior teams, that's where players actually come from. Premiership clubs don't develop them. Championship clubs don't develop them. So every pound you take off there isn't there. So you've got three parts of the RFU. You've got the professional game that they need to do well, because 85% of the money from Twickenham selling internationals is what funds the RFU. So unless you've got a successful national team, which is pro-based, you're not going to get this bit and that bit. The problem is every pound you give from this to this bit or the championship bit comes off that bit. So it's a mutually dependent circle, all of which are understandably saying, more cash, please. We're most important. Well, actually, you're all important. But you almost feel like saying, I think Bill Sweeney should say, right, go into a room, have a fight, come out and tell me which parts of the game, these three, are going to get most money, and which you've agreed. Because if you can't agree, how do you expect me to make the decisions on your behalf when you've got the voting powers? It's a very difficult conundrum. But without radical solutions, especially this championship bit, it's just going to go on and on and on. And I just want to know from the championship clubs, apart from give us more cash, tell me how you are now suddenly going to produce all these players and suddenly become solvent. Because I can't see, and you've not put any argument forward that I can see. I've at least put two solutions forward that I think are workable and have some benefits. I can't see. You tell me your alternative, and well, then we can have a discussion. But at the moment, just saying I want more cash.
I like the sound of a draft system, to be fair, and especially with the success that the Buck Super League has with the universities.
Well, funny enough, in the women's game, because my wife is chair of the PWR, which chair the Women's Professional League, so she's akin to the chair of the PRL. They've got a chance. They're looking, because I said to her at the start, when you go into this, you'll get lots of pressure from the game, the men's game, to say, we do it like this. Say, look, you've got the chance from a blank sheet to write your own thing. And they're looking at things like this to make sure that their bit isn't subject to the failures, and now obviously foreseeable failures because you've seen it happen. So they've got a chance to do that. And they, because of Gloucester Hartbury, because of Loughborough, that is one of the considerations that they can see as well. And not least because it's going to be a long time, hopefully the first 10 years of the PWR are going to set the ground rules and the basis for the whole of, and remember, this is the whole of professional women's game, because New Zealand, although they're good, haven't got any money. Australia nearly bankrupt. South Africa, it's taken a while for them to, so it's hugely important for the whole of world women's rugby that the PWR succeeds, because that's where a lot of the players play anyway. And they're available to do that. So that sort of system, when you've got a blank sheet and you've got cooperation, and this is another thing about involving women making decisions, is that, for example, and this was on, I think, Radio 4, so it's not betraying a confidence. The COO of Saracens went on and said, look, we had a problem with the PWR because we've got a very strong financial sponsor. And the PWR wanted a financial league sponsor. Now, we understand why they wanted one, but they've also got to understand the value to us. So they said, we got together and we found a way to make it work. And I said to my wife, if you'd had two blokes there, it'd have been bang, no, you're not doing this, bang, we are doing this. There'd be an argument and it would never got resolved. It's a way of dealing with things that they have got a chance to bring their skills. And this may well be stereotyping. I've found the longer I've gone on, it is much better to have a balanced gender, let's get this right. Sex is biological, gender is societal, in my opinion. To have that, because you get different ways of thinking and you get different point, especially different approaches to problem solving.
You were recently appointed as a trustee for Women in Sport. Can you tell us how you first got involved in women's rugby?
Well, my first foray into it was in 1991, when England, we were preparing for the home World Cup, where we lost to Australia in the final. And I don't know if you know this, you ought to read it because it's very interesting. Four women from Richmond Rugby Club said, well, if they're having a World Cup, don't you think we should have one? And two of them put their houses up to back this. And they organised an eight-team Women's World Cup that ran alongside, that no one knows about. And they just said, well, let's organise it and do it. They brought people across. The Russian team came across, were selling vodka in the sun in Richmond to try and finance stuff like this. So, and the England, I knew some of the people at Richmond, and one of the women, Sue Dorrington, said, will you come down and help the forwards because I've been in trouble with this, that and the other? And I went down. And to me, it was just people who wanted to improve at rugby. It didn't even really register in the sense that it was a male-female thing. They wanted help. I could help them. I did do. And it went, from there. So the Women in Sport trustee thing was slightly different. I think they've decided, and quite rightly so, that the battle for hearts and minds is such that if you are talking to people who don't like women, then if you have women just doing that, it's not going to have any effect at all. Just take rugby for example. Most of the people who make rugby decisions in governance, who run clubs and do it for free, so it's very difficult to say, are men of my age. You're trying to persuade them. I've got a better chance of persuading them to do initiatives related to girls and women's rugby than just, in conjunction with the women, than them just trying to do it on their own. And it goes back to the whole thing. We've had a big change in policy as a charity, because what we are finding is that whatever initiatives you have, say dads and daughters, mums and daughters doing sport, trying to do that, it's undercut by the fact that the vast majority of governance structures, of disciplinary bodies, of national governing bodies, of sports reporting, of all the media around there, has traditionally been male and is still male. And it's not necessarily a misogynistic thing. It's as much as quite often inattention, because when you want to get help and you've got contacts or you want to cast a net for jobs and what have you, who do you know? And the majority of men know men because they've not had to consider women before.
Do you think it's just all about finding that right balance?
Women's football is finding this. However successful they are, they're still battering against the fact that, you know, men's football, it has very much been a closed shop. You will find, let me give you an example of someone who was phenomenally successful but got no credit at all. Gronoskaya at Chelsea, who was Roman Abramovich's female, not director of football, but head of recruitment. In the years when Chelsea, unlike any other business in the world, sacked like 10 managers in 12 seasons and sacked Ancelotti after he won the double, which is strange, still managed to win more trophies in 20 years than any other team because she was in charge of the football recruitment. So the spine of the team kept, and we've now seen at Chelsea, if you're a Chelsea fan, you've now seen what happens if you give an American lots of cash who knows fuck all about it, because you buy loads of people for 100 million who aren't very good and who don't fit together. So that's just one example. And if you take that one example from one team, imagine what it would be like if you had that in every team, if you had that in every governing body, if you had that in every association. It's been proven. And on the vice versa thing, if you are all women, you don't get a male perspective, you don't get that. So one of the reasons for me and another trustee coming on is to give that male perspective and just say at some point, actually, and things like this are really important. The use of the word misogyny. Misogyny has a very direct meaning, but it's one of these words where the right-wing press, and that's 80% of them, by the way, are very keen, like woke, like Snowflake, to attribute a dismissive tone to this. Anyone who uses that is seen as an agitator, a troublemaker. You could say, don't be anti-women, without saying, it means exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. I just think that's a less confrontational term. And part of my thing, we've been talking about the strategy for women's sport, is saying, look, you're going to have resistance from, if I swear, it's because I'm lazy, but I like swearing. twats in the Daily Mail. I said, you know, anyway, don't give them a hostage to fortune. Don't allow them any leeway in terms of what you say to misinterpret it, to use it in a different way. So just be a bit cuter about it. You're all doing sports journalism. You'll have done lots of things on, you know, the way that things can be slanted, the use of hyperbole, the use of, whatever metaphors are there, and so on. And you'll know how it's very easy to skew things, mm-hmm. if you want to. So part of my job, I think, is to bring a male perspective to say, look, this is can you consider this as a better way of doing this, rather than the basic message, you know, not trying to change the basic message, but this is a perspective which you wouldn't have had I not been here or another male voice.
Are there any, what are the biggest changes you've seen in women's rugby or just women's sport in general since 91 when you first started?
Well, there is some. No, that's not quite true. I mean, there's always been traditional school women's and girls sport, but it's not been taken seriously. It's not been equally funded. The team sports now are just trying to... I mean, was it a record of 120,000 or was it 110 that watched the women's final in the First World War? After which they banned women's football, but because there was no men's football, I think you have to look it up. It was somewhere between 110,000 and 120,000 watched that game. So, you know, you've gone a century from having that to nothing. Then the Lionesses come along and the Red Roses come along, you know, and are successful. It's starting. One of the reasons I think that the Joey Bartons of this world and other people are so angry about what they see as the erosion of male privilege is that women are starting to get a chance to do these things. And once, it's like all these things, once you get a commercial footing for it, then it's starting. And I honestly believe some of the vitriol is because they know deep down that the argument has been won now, in the sense that women deserve to be allowed to play sport. They can do it well. It eventually will be commercially successful. When you see Arsenal selling, you know, the ground out, the Red Roses, if they get to the final of the Women's World Cup in 25, they'll sell Twickenham out without any doubt at all. Once you have started that to be in the public domain and it starts to be successful, which the viewing figures, and presumably you've got these to hand, are there, that argument's been won. It's no longer a case of should it or shouldn't it. It is how it will be done, when it will be done. And so I think a lot of the stuff that's railing in the background from these people is because they know, in the same way that the 60s, you know, moved things on about abortion and other things, the argument has gone from should it be there at all. They don't, you know, and you've still got people who will say that, but you're not going to change their mind anyway. But that argument has been won. It's just a question of how you do it and when it comes.
Right then, it's time for us to take some questions from the audience, Brian. So we're going to start off with Henry.
Yeah, so with the... Well, just wanted to get your take on the comeback Wasps and how that might work and what you think of that whole situation.
There are two big things that English rugby desperately needs to sort out. And they're the same things that have been apparent since he went pro. So it's not as if they don't know about them. It is the pathway from school or junior club minis through to academies and then through to first teams. The academy system is nowhere near what it should be, even if it should exist in its present format at all, in producing, maintaining the players a number that it should do. And secondly, is reforming tiers 2 and 3, which at the moment are hoovering resources without producing anything. And I know that's going to make me unpopular. I don't give a shit, because it's true. I believe that the Premiership themselves, they are not unhappy that the numbers are what they are now, because a lot of them have always believed that there are too many teams. And it's no good having teams that aren't financially at least stable, even if you mean by stable, people are willing to underwrite losses, because that's what it is at the moment. I don't have any problem with that. But we can't have a situation again where they go under, you know. And to blame other people like they are, if it's your fault. Well, no, it's not actually, because it was you who chose to run 5 businesses, you know, and run a hotel and a stadium and other things. And it was you who went out and sold the shares. And by the way, you shouldn't be asking people like Lawrence Dallaglio to go and sell shares in things if they're not financially qualified, because it's not fair to them, because it's actually borderline, well, it's not great financial practice, let's say. So I don't have a problem with that. They've got to find a level to come in, and they've got why are the French able to do something different? Because in France, there is a corner of the country, the southwest, where rugby is strongest, where the situation in Britain does not apply, and it's this: football is a second sport in that area of France. I don't know if you know, Toulouse are in Ligue 1. So are you know about Marseille. So are Montpellier. But their rugby teams are bigger, so you might not know that they are the equivalent of Premier League football sides. That doesn't happen anywhere else in England. That means that local, they've got two of the massive advantages. Because of the way France has been set up since the revolution and the civic pride aspect, a lot of them, these stadiums, they don't have to run. They're council-run stadiums, they're council-owned. So all those costs are out. And finally, and this is what no one wants to mention, and it's no one's fault or benefit, both in Ireland and France, their tax laws, because of entertainers and their athletes classed as entertainers, when they retire, they get anywhere between 40 and 60% of the tax that they've paid back. I know one Irish player played in a generation after me, now retired. When he retired, he got a cheque for €600,000. That is a big incentive to still play in France or still play in Ireland, isn't it? And that's no one's fault, that's just the way the tax system is. But what we're saying is, you've got football being a secondary sport, which hoovers up, which allows brands to want to put the money into rugby before football in this area. The tax system, the municipal ownership system, you've got a system which is more easily made to work. And the French have a higher cap, but before the season starts, they have to prove that they've got the money to last the whole season. And if they go over the cap, they get properly whacked. It's not, you know, wait 6 years like Saracens. You can cheat for 6 years and then get caught. You know, you get smacked straight away. But it's a different thing. I mean, you go to France. I remember going to Agen with Richmond for a pre-season tour. And we went to a little village in southwest France near Agen. And I went into one of the local bars in the little town square, and someone recognised Craig Quill, and someone said to me, "Oh, Moel," and I thought, "Oh shit, this is not going to go well, is it?" And they went and got the mayor, and he went and said hello to everyone, and you know that just doesn't exist in England. There's no area like that, and that's the reason why in that part of France it is peculiarly powerful. But that's the only area that you've got it, apart from a country like New Zealand, in which it's been in their DNA for 100 years, or South Africa, which is just a freakish country in this sense. They managed to produce players of inordinate size, and now they've got, you know, the inclusive 69 million people who weren't playing under apartheid. You've got their athletic talent, and they just keep producing astonishingly good players, whether they keep them domestically or not. I don't know of any other country that does that. Nowhere near.
Right then, Emil has a question.
Yeah, hi Brian. When you were talking earlier about like the RFU and obviously split the funds between the championship and the premiership, do you think that's just like a wider issue with rugby? Because for instance, like I know with the WRU, the Cardiff Blues for example, which is the WRU's most profitable region, and even they're making cutbacks with the Ballot House and the internationals who've been there for, you know, 10 plus years, and some of them are now making less than people in mainstream 9-to-5 jobs.
The problems that the RFU have with their secondary tier and their pathways are replicated in other countries when it needn't be. Ireland have got a much better system because when the game went pro, in Ireland, you've the top teams, the top four teams, and certainly top three anyway, Munster, Leinster and Ulster, they were the regional representative teams anyway. So everyone who went up the pyramid from their clubs, that was a top anyway. So when you come into pros, that's great. In Scotland, there was no real opportunity because otherwise it's a smaller playing base. It had to be Edinburgh and Glasgow. In Wales and England, you had to have, this was a decision, and I was there, right there at the specific time. You had to make this decision. Do we concentrate the talent in regions, or do we allow the clubs to do it? Because if you allow the clubs to do it, if you say, right, these are our eight professional clubs, and Pontypool aren't in it, you're too young, I'm not being dismissive about this. Pontypool dominated Welsh rugby for 10 years, and they won everything. By the time professionalism came round, they weren't doing that anymore. If you'd have said, Clenethley are going to be it, Pontypool would have gone crazy. Same with Neath. Neath had a decade when they did everything. They had to choose between nominating the clubs, and what they did was, they said, what we're not going to do is cost politics too much. We're going to merge them into regions, which unfortunately satisfied nobody because people said, I don't want to be part of Neath, Swansea. I'm a Neath fan, not a bloody Swansea. And so you've had to try and build that up. Only Cardiff stayed as a club stroke region. In England, they didn't even bother to do that. They just said, oh, fight it out. Which is why Newcastle came in, John Hall, the transfer fees, which is why London Welsh have gone bust, which is why all these things got, because they politically couldn't find a way to decide to do it. If you had a blank sheet of paper for professionalism, what you would have done in the Northern Hemisphere is you'd say, right, tell you what, we will have a league that has five French clubs in it, five English clubs, three Irish clubs, three Welsh clubs, two Scottish ones. That's a top tier, and then you work down from there. And then you'd have had all the broadcast deals, all the, you know, you'd have had the excitement and the pathway that goes with the best rugby, which is European rugby. Because they didn't do that, and I understand in certain respects why they couldn't do that in England, and they've now got a situation where you've got clubs versus country, which is almost insurmountable. You know, England are labouring on their third professional game agreement to try and get 8 stable years where everyone agrees who you can pick, how long the clubs have them for, who's paid what. If they don't have that, it's a free-for-all. In France, they've managed to buy, you know, they've done the deal financially, but the financial situation is different. The problems are very similar. The solutions are not necessarily easy. And now that these decisions have been made, I don't know how you turn them back, because, I mean, would it be better if you went back to just being Swansea or Neath? Because the regions, you know, Ospreys, Lance Bradley, a good friend of mine, difficult to do. I'd like to give solutions. I don't think I'm clever enough. It's not because of the way it started. I don't know what you do.
Okay then, Toby, you're with the next question.
Hi, Ryan. I've seen you've been quite outspoken about the possibility of there being hail in the Six Nations. You've obviously talked a lot about the lack of finances within English rugby. I mean, when you compare it to cricket, which is a sort of similar kind of level sport, 75% of the ECB's revenue comes from Sky.
I know what you mean. I mean, look, because rugby's a minority, it doesn't matter to football. Football gets so much money. It doesn't actually need crowds at the very highest level. I mean, they're there because it makes the game better on TV. Chelsea don't need crowds to make money. The broadcast deal is enough. The difficulty you've got is with rugby and cricket. As a minority sport, you cannot rely on people walking through the doors of your clubs or running to school where it's not played and saying, we demand to play football, you know. You will not suddenly get kids starting to run around in a playground, for example, where they will do with a football. That's what I did when I was at a rugby school. You know, during break times, when it's concrete, I'm not running around with a rugby ball. We're kicking the football, because that's what we've been taught to do. And you'll never change that. So you need the exposure for people to have the hero's seat to be it, as well as the cash. And that's a difficulty. If you put it all behind a paywall, you will not get that. 2005... I don't know how you. A lot of you won't even remember this. When England had a massive Ashes series at home, it was a brilliant Ashes series of 5 tests, nearly every session of which was brilliant. And they went to Downing Street. That was the one where Flintoff and Peterson looked so pissed they could hardly walk. Right, 2005 was the last time an Ashes series was on terrestrial TV. In the 10 years since it went to Sky, the ECB announced record turnover, record profits, record investment in the county game. Playing numbers went down by 35% because people weren't seeing it. I defy even you who are, you know, sports-minded and whatever, to recognise some of the England squad and the 11 that have just played in India. Joe Root, maybe, a few others. You know. No, you. Well, you will, but no, but everyone else. But that's the point. Rugby and cricket have to have that terrestrial bit to grow or stand still. Because what? This is another thing people don't realise. Everyone is trying to get the diminishing number of kids who actually want to play sport or actually made to play sport to play their sport, and that includes football. My twins, I've got 7-year-old twins, my twins' junior school, their after-school stuff is run by Fulham. Now, they're not teaching football, But when, you know, if my daughters turn out to be good footballers or the kids who are there, who gets first dibs at saying, come along to our, you know, our under whatever it is? Fulham are going to. But they do that for free. So the schools are saying, great, we don't have to pay for it. So, you know, if you're a cricket in the Wimbledon area or you're rugby, you've got football clubs and big football clubs, really well organised, glamorous football clubs that they see on telly, who are, you know, organising your kids' school sport. So you've got that as well. So you can't rely. You have to have, in my opinion, you have to have a terrestrial TV presence. The numbers are anywhere between 1 and 15 times as many people watching, depending on what event it is. You know, Six Nations, when you get 9 million people watching England, France, if 9 million people were rugby fans, it'd be the national sport, and it's not, so they don't. You know, at Sky, TNT, their average club game, between 200,000 and 300,000. You know, without being dismissive, because I like the people at TNT, not necessarily commentator, but because of Austin Healey. But anyway, no, don't play. You can do. I don't care. they actually get more viewers for their snooker coverage. Seriously, and I know this because I had breakfast because he lives in Wimbledon, the head of TNT European Sport. And this is the, you know, people get, and you should learn about, you should be told about this or find out about it, because it's part of, you know, journalism and whatever. These assumptions that everyone is awash with money like football, they are not true. People need to find out the actual figures, participation, viewership, the actual amount of sponsorship, and the actual amount of broadcast deals that are done. When the Six Nations, two periods ago, when RBS were the sponsors, a mate of mine who just happened to sit next to me at school from the age of 11, turned out to have worked for the TCCB as well then CB, set his own sponsorship firm up. His personal clients, he's retired three times now, multimillionaire, were Coca-Cola, BMW, Vodafone, you know, very, very, very big clients. And he organised the RBS deal. And he told me that when the RBS went to, it was on 12 million, and they said, we'll give you 14. And the people at the Six Nations Committee, who have never run anything, not they said, no, we think it's worth 20. And they said, fuck off. 20? Said, so we're not doing it. And they held out and held out. When they didn't renew at 14, they had to accept 6 million from Diageo. So not only did you not get 2 million increase, you got a 6 million decrease. This is what happens if you're stupid in sport and you start to talk about things you don't understand against broadcasters who have the cash. And it's something that, as you know, as responsible journalists, which, you know, or responsible media people, you ought to, you know, you ought to arm yourself with these facts before you start writing nonsense about they should get this, they should get that. I still keep him. The Championship should get a TV deal. And you don't know his name, but the guy from TNT said, under no circumstances would we ever cover the Championship unless we were made to, and it was because it costs us money. Outside broadcasts cut a lot of cash each time. Said, you're filming to not even half full stadium. Said, you're filming on some grounds that don't even have a stadium or have one stand that's not full. Said, what does that do? I know Amazon, the guy from Amazon, their debrief, because I've seen the document, the guy from Amazon said, they're not going to go back into doing the documentaries. He said, because these are the following difficulties with rugby. People don't understand the rules, they're too complicated. The game stops and starts too much. Not all the stadia are full for Premiership stuff. Lack of engagement in this sense. Why would I, as a viewer, care about Newcastle Gloucester if I'm not from Newcastle or Gloucester, or I'm not a rugby fan? Is there a reason for me to care? No. So when you're talking about generic potential sports fans and all these things come up, Amazon said, sorry, we're not doing it anymore. If you can't address those things, you're not going to get the broadcast deal. So you don't even get to the point when you're talking about should it be terrestrial or should we pay, you don't get anything. So unless you can start addressing those, then we can have the other debate about what the percentage should be. Because the problem is, let's take this for example. When Sky took the England games on their own and everyone wanted to kick England out of the Six Nations, the viewing figures went down by a factor of, 20th. You know, from millions to one game being about an eighth, a million, I think was the highest they got. They might have crept up now because Sky is available in more homes and on more platforms. But you've still got a substantial difference. So it's a very long-winded answer, but hopefully it's relatively comprehensive as to why I think it's absolutely essential that you need both. And that is in any minority sport.
Right, the questions are rolling in thick and fast. We've got Ricky up next.
Right, Brian. Pleasure to meet you, firstly. I noticed on Twitter that you're a bit of a fan of the NFL.
Massive, yeah.
Do you support the team person for it?
Well, no, I mean, and people, do you know, in this country, you are far more likely to get divorced than change your sports team by a factor of about 15. Seriously. It's just true. And people, you know, there's only ever been one franchising sports decision in this country, apart from the 100, which is slightly different. Can you remember what it was in football? It was Milton Keynes Dons and Wimbledon AFC. And it's still causing trouble to this very day. That's how fans pick their teams and stick with them in England. And strangely, I've watched NFL since the very first broadcast in 1982. I remember it being in the junior common room at Nottingham Sherwood Hall University. That was the year that Redskins won, as they were then called. The Commanders won with Riggins and Theismann. And I've just loved American football ever since then, but I've never had a team. And when you say this to English people, they look at you a bit weird and say, what do you mean? Well, you can't really be a fan then. So, no, I am a big fan. I probably know more than you. And I've probably been to more games, certainly at Wembley, luckily, than you. But for some reason, I've just never, maybe because it's physical proximity, I've never felt the need. And one of the things, because I was with Brett Gosper, who is head of NFL Europe, and I was saying to him, when you come to try and establish a London franchise, London Mall, he said, you've got to be really careful, he said, thinking that English or British NFL fans will suddenly support a London team. So because they've had, like I've had, 40 years of following the Raiders, the Patriots, and they've bought all their stuff, they are set for life, and they will not change their allegiance. So when it comes to their team playing against the London Monarchs, whatever they call them, you'll have half the stadium, especially if it's, you know, mad fans like the Raiders fans, you know, you'll have them there. So you can't assume that British people consume. You know, it's well known in America, you can move the franchise from city to city and people will stay loyal. That never happens here. It just doesn't happen. So no, I don't have a team. And people find it really weird. The reason I love the game is I think it's one of the most professional games. One of my strength and conditioning coaches, who I didn't employ him, he was just an Australian guy who I met down the gym, who used to work with the then LA Rams, and he was telling me about the linemen, and he was saying, I physically find it difficult to lift some of the dumbbells with two hands that they use as dumbbells back onto the racks after they've been using them. He said, so these guys, he said, 6'8", 300 pounds, physically couldn't run a mile, literally couldn't run a mile, but over 40 yards, not super quick, but quick enough for you not to be able to get away from them, and then 300 pounds hits you. And he said, they are so specialist that they can say about linemen, if you want me to play 16 games, I can only do two downs at a time, because my body will give away. If you want me to do 12, three, if you want me to do all four downs on a set, I might last half a season. because and they've worked it out so specifically. I don't know if you remember when Germany won the World Cup three or four tournaments ago, there was a big thing made of three German students who'd put together a DVD, as was then, if you remember what DVDs were. You probably don't, actually. For the German team, covering every opponent that they might possibly come across, and their strengths and weaknesses, all their stats. And the British press said, isn't that marvellous? I said, every single high school in America has that for NFL. Every college team has a library that is professional teams. I said, when you're talking about the professionalism of English Premiership Premier League football in terms of statistics and analysis, that is not even high school standard. And a lot of people say, well, it isn't susceptible in the same way because you can't plan, and that's true. Having said that, you know, there are ways of using analysis which could benefit football, which they don't use. And actually, the argument that they use against it is, well, how successful are you? Because we're the most successful league in the world in football, which they are. So, and we don't need it. I love it because it's susceptible of being analysed that way. I think it's fascinating. I think the, you know, the amalgam of utter scrutiny against when things go wrong and you're scrambling, you know, is fascinating as well. And I just think it's a... I understand why people don't like it, because it's one of these games where if you don't even know something about it, it's incomprehensible, isn't it? Just, you have no idea what's going on. So I do understand that, but for those reasons, I really enjoy the game.
Jason?
Oh, yeah, hello.
Hello.
I'm from the US.
Yeah.
I'm not too knowledgeable about rugby.
Well, no, you really I should be.
But I was going to ask you, I don't hear too much about the sport there. And I wanted to get your thoughts on like what the state of rugby is like in the US and if you think it's growing.
Well, look, I mean, no, I fully understand. I totally understand that. Well, hopefully you'll hear more about it because there's going to be a World Cup there shortly. And it's a big gamble for World Rugby because most people won't know this. When the 2011 World Cup went to New Zealand, they made £11 million. And remember that World Rugby, nearly all their funding comes from the World Cup. They had to have it back in England in 2015 because England gave them £350 million. And when it went to Japan, the Japanese government underwrote a guaranteed sum of $180 million. When it goes to America, who knows? There are massive corporations, there are massive TV companies. They might be able to do it. If they don't, it will be one which I don't think it will lose money. But every time you have a development area for a World Cup in rugby, you are almost forced to come back to England or France because you can guarantee hundreds of millions of pounds are going to be made and World Rugby needs that. But that means allegations of it being unfair, but then you say, well, do you want the cash or don't you? Because you need that to fund Fiji and, you know, all these things. The problem with in America has always been this. Everyone's always said, and it's I hate cliches because they're lazy. But like a lot of cliches, there's partial truth is, if you could harness the talent, the physical talent that is dropped off from American football, you'd have athletes that could do this. What they've failed to understand, and yeah, I'd be interested in your opinion on this, is in America, if you stop playing football at high school level, you don't play at college. If you stop at college, you don't go down the road and play in an amateur team in many sports. Baseball you maybe do, minor, you know. They don't do that in American football. You don't have teams that just turn up, you know, they just don't do it. There's not that tradition. So people don't carry on playing. And by the way, it's been categorically proven. If you think of it, it's so obvious, isn't it? To understand the nuances, which is why very few players, Luis Rees-Zammit is about to find this out, who go to American football, 18 or over, never get to the grips with it, even if they're talented enough, because they don't intrinsically understand it, because they've not been playing since they were five. The playbooks are this thick, they can't get to grips with them, and whatever talent they've got, they just don't fit in. The same in rugby is the same. You can teach rote skills like lineouts and scrums. You can teach them and try. What happens in the rest of the game, which is like when a move goes wrong and they have to scramble, where's Kelsey? Has he got, you know, oh, he's up there with Taylor Swift, but anyway. But, you know, you've got that. Then you find out, you know, these route runners who are running and then they suddenly get free and get the space, they make the separation. This is when the intrinsic knowledge of the game comes in. And you can't teach that from the age of 18. Or if you do, by the time you've actually got it, everything's moved on. The other problem with America, the sport, is this. It's played on the East Coast and the West Coast. And people don't understand there are 3,000 miles in between. And to fly anywhere to play or meet in the middle for sessions is bloody expensive. It costs billions to start a professional game off, as Rugby League has found. It is almost impossible to establish a professional game from scratch somewhere. Until you can get, and it started in American colleges, which is why you've got even the base you've got now. Until you can get it in schools, you won't get that bit. But again, in America, the NFL are trying to compete for kids. So the NBA, so the NHL, so is the soccer league now. You know, and you're talking about rugby that doesn't have any background there, doesn't have any money to do that, competing. And you know, the thing about the NFL, and all the other, well, not the NBA, but, and certainly not the the baseball,
NRB,
is this. In the most capitalist country in the world, it is the most communist system you've ever seen, isn't it? Where you all get there, everyone shares the thing, you get your bit, you're not allowed to do anything, we all own everything, to the extent to which, if you're shit 1 year, we don't allow you to outspend people, you get to pick the best players. You couldn't get a more socialist, you know, sort of experiment, but it's phenomenally successful. Every year, they look at the budget, the owners take that bit, the players get that bit, and bang. And it all works, and because he's absolutely, but it's been developed over 100 years, and people playing it through school. I remain very sceptical as to whether America can be made to be successful simply because of the unique challenges of not having professional, of establishing a professional game, and the sheer cost of having to, you know, if you have to play, it's a flight, you know, you're talking about 40 odd players flying across, then having hotel bills, you know, that costs a lot of money. Who's going to back that? I would love to say, because I do believe the athletic talent is there, but for all these reasons, I'm not sure how it can be harnessed, and I'm not sure how it can be financed, which is a real shame.
Well, there we go. Who thought that we'd end up on American rugby? But yeah, thank you very much for today, Brian. You've definitely given us plenty to chew on.
All I'd say is this, look, these are my opinions. What I've tried to do as a journalist, as a broadcaster, it takes a second to lose your integrity and a long time to build it up. When I say something or I write something, I have looked at the facts as I see them or as I've been told them. I've weighed them up because I'm a former lawyer of a long time. I've argued them myself and then I've come to an opinion. I don't write things or say things just to be controversial, even though if you start to work in sports journalism, you will find, like every other journalist, there is pressure for clicks, for bait, because the number of platforms now, the number of podcasts, the only way to stand out, people now think, and it's a proven way, is to be outrageous. And you can get there, but the longevity isn't there. If you get it right, and it takes time to build a brand, then you become trusted and whatever. And I think I've got to the stage where people do trust that at least there's a reason for me saying this. That doesn't mean to say I'm right, because it's an opinion. And I won't apologise for my opinion, because it's what it is, and it's well-reasoned, hopefully. I will apologise if I get facts wrong, because you shouldn't get facts wrong. And if you don't know a fact, you should say you don't know one. You can still give an opinion, but you shouldn't be pretending that you do have them, and that it's solidly based. And I say to some people, some of the journalists, I said, you can't possibly believe everything you write. Because I can show you articles from month to month, which say completely different things. You can't. And if I change, I do occasionally look back at certain subjects as to what I've written before. Generally, I don't need to, because I know what conclusions I've come to and how I got there. And if I change my mind on something, I will write and I will put it plainly and say, change my mind because of this. But I think you've got to do that to have credibility. And also, it's down to this. I don't know what sort of people you are or you think you are. If you earn your living in a way that other people consider to be a bit cheap or being nasty or being underhand, or is that really what you want? Because I mean, and I am going to pull rank on this sense. I'm 62 now. How long have I got? Eddie Butler's died, commentating partner, JPR's gone. I'm looking at myself and thinking, how many years have you actually got left? Like, will you settle for 20? Might do if we're all healthy. Might go tomorrow. You'll start to think, what have I actually done? Have I done anything worthwhile? And look, I don't mean necessarily doing... I'm trying not to be pejorative and begetted here. Things like being an international or whatever. Being a really good professional. And that professionalism has nothing to do with being paid. It's about how you comport yourself relative to the task in hand. It's how you do your job, how your relationships are. You know, when you look back, are you happy with what you've done? Because that's really important. And it's really important from here going forward. You know, and I promise, look, I had a heart attack 7 years ago. And for the brief time, and it was very brief, that I thought I actually might die, I didn't think about anything to do with how much money I'd made, what I'd achieved on there. I just thought about people I'm not going to see again. And I thought, what will they think? What will they think of me? Will they miss me? Will they respect me? I'm adopted, but my adoptive dad taught physically and mentally handicapped kids for 30 years of the care and what have you. Never made any money. When he had his funeral, quite unexpectedly, hundreds of people turned up at the church. And I didn't know any of them. And they came along. Scores of people bothered to come up to me and said, look, you don't know me, but I just wanted to come and say goodbye to your dad because he did this favour to me, or he was very kind to me, or I respect him for this reason. I just wanted to mark that. And I thought to myself, this is a really good test of what you've achieved in life. Not obligated, people will come because they have to come because, you know, you're a national figure or you're this, that and the other. How many people will turn up at your funeral because they thought you were a good person and you've made a difference? And that, I think, is really, really important. You know, I think it's as good a guiding light as you can have. And I've not understood that for quite a while. And now I'm trying, in the moments I've got left, to be less self-centered, more useful. And I know this sounds very new age and whatever, but for various reasons in my life, I've had periods of darkness. And I've worked my way to trying to get more periods of light. But part of that, of the whole thing, is your self-esteem. And I don't mean it being measured by outside achievement and seemingly honours boards and things like that. I mean it, you being able to sit in your quiet moments and think, yeah, that was good, I've done that well. People saying to you, yep, we respect that, we like what you've done there. That is huge. That is more important. It is a better way to live, in my opinion. It's certainly a better way to be remembered.